When we picture the struggle for Irish independence, we most often recall events that unfolded on Irish soil. In the GPO, for example, in rural ambushes in Dáil Éireann. But during that same period, another front in that struggle took shape across the water in the Irish communities of Britain. A new book, Conflict, Diaspora and Empire, Irish Nationalism in Britain, 1912 to 1922, invites us to rethink the geography of Irish nationalism and to consider what occurred in the streets and meeting halls of London, Liverpool and Glasgow, where Irish migrants were gathering, organising and even smuggling arms in support of Irish independence. They played a vital role in shaping public opinion, influencing political debates, and creating a new Irish identity at the heart of the British Empire. I'm joined now by the author, historian Dr. Dara Gannon, Associate Director of Global Irish Studies at Georgetown University. Dara, you're very welcome back to the History Show.
It's great to be with you, Miles.
Now, one of those emigrants, possibly the most celebrated emigrant of the early 20th century, one Michael Collins, spent a significant portion of his life in London. So before we get to the broader story, how do you think Collins's formative years in the heart of the empire shaped his revolutionary persona and his political instincts?
Well, you're quite correct. In fact, you could think of it in terms of Collins's very short life. One third of that life was actually spent living in exile in the heart of empire in London. So while Collins was born in Clonakilty, County Cork in 1890, he in fact emigrated to London in 1906. And there he was, the proverbial Mick on the make, to use Roy Foster's term, rising to the highest echelons of the city life in London, first working in the Postal Office Savings Bank and then a stockbroker's office in the city. But he really found, I think, his iconoclastic political home in the London IRB. And it's there that his political godfather, Sam Maguire, the famous Sam Maguire, administered the oath to allow Collins to enter the Fenian movement in 1909. And this is where Collins really came of age in the Irish Republican movement, staying there until about January 1916, whereupon he traversed the Irish Sea to take part in the 1916 Rising.
So let's go back to the early years of the 20th century, to the pre-First World War years. How did Irish communities in Britain help shape what Irish nationalism looked like in that period before 1914? Were they just supporting what was happening back home, or were they actively influencing the Home Rule movement?
Well, it's a really important aspect of this book to establish that the Irish community in Britain were not a sideshow to the events which led to Irish independence in 1922, but were rather integral to both Irish and British assessments of what the Irish Revolution actually was. And when you think about the Irish question in the early 20th century, it's actually the Irish in Britain who are the most salient and visible reminder to British politicians of what that politics looked like, because, as you've noted in your introduction, they were living in cities like London, Liverpool, Manchester, Glasgow and Cardiff, where votes were being taken on the Home Rule issue. And I suppose if you look at the early 20th century, the definitive political movement in Irish political terms was the Irish Parliamentary Party at Westminster. But this book offers a different perspective on the IPP. In fact, the IPP at Westminster are only cited four times. Hansard, the parliamentary papers, are only cited four times in the entire book. I take a different approach to look at the Irish Party and establish their extra-parliamentary lives by night very often in Britain. For example, John Redmond, who was known as the leader of the Irish Party, essentially had a double life. During the day, he sat at Westminster and championed the cause for Home Rule. But at night, he was one of the key speakers on the circuit of the Irish in Britain, speaking to political audiences around the country on the nature of Home Rule and the significance of the Home Rule Bill in 1912.
So on the one hand, he is a politician who is allied to the Liberals. On the other hand, he is supporting, I suppose, or at least is proselytizing amongst the Irish diaspora with more nationalist rhetoric than he would produce perhaps in the House of Commons.
You're absolutely correct. And he is a masterful politician in that respect. He understands his audiences, plural. In the book, I've characterized the Irish Party more broadly as having a campaign which was the two faces of Home Rule. On one hand, they offered a version of Home Rule, a revision of Home Rule, which would appeal to British political audiences at Westminster and beyond. And simultaneously, they spoke, I guess you could say, out of the other side of their mouths to Irish political audiences in Britain and at home. And this book suggests that in 1910, despite the success of the Irish Party in securing the Liberal alliance and the balance of power at two successive general elections, that John Redmond and the Irish Party leadership understood that the British political electorate still had to be convinced as to the virtues of Irish Home Rule. So remarkably, as Home Rule was being read aloud in 1912, entered into the as a bill in the House of Commons, approximately 500 political meetings were held across Britain in 1912 by the Irish Party leadership to try and convince and present a compelling case for Home Rule to British audiences. And this has not been documented before.
And to what extent were Irish nationalist groups being influenced by other things that were going on in Britain at the time, by the suffrage movement, for example, by the rise of trade unionism as well?
You're quite correct. And if you look at that kind of Edwardian or late Edwardian period, the Irish Party was one of a number of political campaigns which essentially marked that period in British political life. And they were very interconnected in British cities. One thing we should note regarding the Home Rule movement of Britain led by the United Irish League of Great Britain was that women actually had more visibility in the British side of the Irish Party than they did in Ireland itself. And a case in point would be, for example, Sophie Bryant, who was actually on the executive of the United Irish League of Great Britain. And she was that quintessential personification of the Edwardian suffragette, political activist, artist, and writer. Elsewhere, you see in London in particular, members of the Women's Social and Political Union speaking at Home Rule events. That's not to say, of course, that John Redmond was persuaded by these suffragist claims, and the Irish Party as a bloc voted against suffrage bills twice in 1913. But in terms of public visibility, the Irish Home Rule question was very much attached to more progressive claims for both trade unionism and suffragism in British cities.
Now, the period we've been talking about is pre-World War One. Obviously, the world completely changes in 1914. How did the Irish in Britain respond to the outbreak of World War One?
This is really a key question, Miles, because very often in the history books up until the last 20 years, and you know this better than anyone, the First World War was the subject of public amnesia in kind of Irish cultural life, notwithstanding Irish historiography. Now, thankfully, we have rectified that in the last 20 years in terms of books written on the subject. But a key part of that question is the mobilization of Irish communities in Britain into the British Armed Forces. To give you some numbers, by the spring of 1915, approximately 115,000 Irish men resident in Britain enrolled in the British Armed Forces. It's estimated there are approximately 1.5 million people of Irish descent in Britain at that time. So that's about 10%, which is a remarkable figure. But what's also really crucial is that the response of the Irish in Britain is very often documented happening after the enaction of Home Rule. So Home Rule is introduced into the statute books on the 18th of September 1914. And crucially, for the purposes of our conversation today, John Redmond's speech, his Guns of August speech on the 3rd of August in the House of Commons, is valued and valored by the Irish in Britain as espousing a British-Irish response to the First World War, a pro-imperial but also pro-Home Rule response to the First World War. And so the Irish in Britain respond to the idea of a future Home Rule within the British Empire.
How then did the Easter Rising, and particularly obviously the British response to the Easter Rising and the British response in Dublin, how did that transform political opinion among the Irish diaspora communities in Britain?
I suppose in many ways we have been persuaded as a society by the eloquence of W.B. Yeats. All changed utterly when it comes to the responses to the 1916 rising. And Yeats, of course, dates the transformation of public opinion to the execution of the leaders at Kilmainham and elsewhere. However, if we look at the Irish in Britain as a community, we see an adjacent space in which that changing public opinion emerges. And it's predominantly in relation to the internees and prisoners who arrive in Britain, for example, at Frongoch in Wales, after the Rising. Approximately 2,500 men and women are deported to British prisons and internment camps. And for the first time, members of the Irish community in British cities actually see the people behind the profile of the 1916 Rising, and they recognise that these are young men and women predominantly who look respectable, who are very presentable. And so this is not the version of the Sinn Féin rebellion presented in the British media. And lest we forget, of course, that censorship is at play during the First World War. You know, patriotism is at play during the First World War. So the British media have concocted a very Germanic version of the 1916 Rising. And of course, this is inflected by Roger Casement's seditious connections to the German Empire. But when these rebels come into view in British cities to Irish emigrants, they recognize them as ordinary rebels who essentially were following orders in the tried and true First World War form.
And then during the War of Independence, was there tension in the Irish community in Britain? How did the British respond to the Irish community in Great Britain as members of the security forces were being killed in Ireland?
There was a significant response to the ongoing Irish War of Independence. Most obviously, politically and publicly, we see the establishment of the Irish Self-Determination League of Great Britain. And this is essentially a Sinn Féin body, a public body, which promotes and propagates for Dáil Éireann throughout 1919, 1920 and 1921. Now, I should say that this is not automatically a popular movement. In fact, in 1919, they have about 3,000 members in England and Wales, which approximates to about 1% of the entire population. So why were they not as popular in 1919 as they would become? And it was because, in some respects, actually, the Irish question had fallen off the agenda in British political life in the immediate aftermath of the First World War. David George Boyce has noted that the British public became bored with the question of Ireland before the War of Independence had intensified. And you see that actually, for example, when the Dáil Loan is launched by Michael Collins in 1919, the Irish in Britain contribute, in his own words, a miserly £6,000. And he says it's an enormous reminder of how the Irish in Britain forget about their ethnicity. But by 1920, we have a number of events which really transform the view of what the Irish are fighting for back across the Irish Sea. Most notably, the hunger strike of Terence McSweeney between August and October of 1920 captures the imagination of the Irish in Britain. And the ISDL and Sinn Féin are essentially natural propagandists, to use David Lloyd George's famous term. They use the emotion of religiosity at that time. They stage McSweeney's funeral cortege through London, most notably. They have masses across Britain, and they capture this mood of religiosity in late 1920. And the Irish in Britain respond. By 1921, approximately 54,000 were joining Sinn Féin and the ISDL. At a time, I should note, when that movement was essentially being targeted by British intelligence and by the British state. So by 1921, Sinn Féin is essentially a respectable movement in the eyes of the Irish in Britain.
And to talk a little bit more about the notion of the Irish in Britain during the War of Independence as being some sort of fifth column or enemy within. I mean, how closely were they being monitored by the British authorities, or how closely was militant activity being monitored in Britain by the authorities and by the Secret Service?
Very closely indeed. If you look, for example, I mean, this book is based on research in archives from 35 British cities. But I guess the in terms of establishing the significance of Irish activism in Britain, we really have to look at the records of the British state held at Kew in the National Archives in London. And the Irish activists are being documented by the Home Office, by the Colonial Office, in the Cabinet, and so on and so forth. To give you one example, the Home Office established in the aftermath of the First World War a Directorate of Intelligence, which has weekly reports to the British Cabinet on revolutionary organizations in Britain. And that includes communists, criminals, you know, demobilized soldiers, and Sinn Féin are a weekly category in those reports. And evidently, when the IRA launched their campaign in Britain, most notably the attacks on the Liverpool docks on the 27th of November, 1920, this raises the pitch to fever pitch. This raises the alarm to fever pitch. And one of the things I establish in the book is that while the attack on the Liverpool docks was actually quite small scale, incendiary attacks of timber yards, essentially, it's the response of British policymakers which denotes how important the Irish in Britain were considered. For example, the events of November 1920 in Liverpool take place in the same week as both Bloody Sunday in Dublin and Kilmichael in Cork. And yet the Liverpool attacks, small scale though they were, are the feature of three separate cabinet discussions, more than either than Kilmichael or Bloody Sunday. And it's my contention in the book that the British state considered the threat of Sinn Féin, again, going back to this idea of Fenianism from the middle of the 19th century, as a more significant threat than the events in Ireland itself.
And then how do those activists respond to the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty? Were the divisions evident in Ireland also evident in Britain?
Very much so. The movement in Britain does split. Now, it's not the same as in Ireland in terms of an almost equal split within the movements. In England, the Irish Self-Determination League loses members. They go from about 38,000 to 20,000 in 6 months because many who are more moderate, more politically oriented, consider that the Irish question has been solved, that there is a home or a free state parliament, you know, built into the Anglo-Irish Treaty. In Scotland, they're more radical. They're certainly more Republican. They're also quite socialist because of the influence of James Connolly and others. And they take a very hard line against the treaty. So there is a divide between England and Scotland in that space. Individuals are a really important factor here. The well-worn phrase, what's good enough for Mick, that being Michael Collins, is good enough for me, really holds true. And Collins has a very strong base in London, even years after leaving his adopted city. The one, or rather the two, exceptions to that rule, of course, were Reginald Dunne and Joseph O'Sullivan, members of the London IRA, who had fought in the First World War, who would ultimately assassinate Sir Henry Wilson on the streets of London on the 22nd of June, 1922. And of course, it's one of the great what-ifs of Irish history as to who ordered that particular assassination. Was Collins complicit? And so in some respects, that's the unresolved question.
It's more or less beyond the scope, I suppose, of your book, the dateline of the book anyway, finishing in 1922. But the disillusionment, that political disillusionment that sets in, I suppose, after the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, who were the beneficiaries of that? Was it the trade union movement? Was it the British Labour Party?
Absolutely. In reality, the Anglo-Irish Treaty essentially brings to a close a certain chapter in British-Irish history, which we started at the conversation with the Home Rule movement and we end with the Anglo-Irish Treaty. And that's recognised by contemporaries. John Dillon, for example, the leader of the Irish Party after John Redmond's death in 1918, literally uses the phrase that this is a closed chapter of Irish history. But we can see this shift or transition towards the Irish taking part in the labour movement specifically well before 1922. During the First World War, when the Representation of the People Act is introduced in 1918, T.P. O'Connor, the ostensibly the face of Irish nationalism in the Home Rule years in Britain, recognises the Irish are leaving the Home Rule movement and entering into the party and the structures of the labour movement. And two very clear examples of that, which predate the treaty, I suppose, is James Connolly and Big Jim Larkin, who essentially are blocked from positions of political leadership because of their very strong labour views in that period. So the Irish migrate towards the labour question after 1922. And I guess the book makes the argument that this is a discrete period in British-Irish history, but also significantly that to fully understand the events leading to Irish independence, we must read those through the prism of both British and Irish history.
Well, it's all a reminder that the fight for Irish independence didn't just happen in Ireland, but also in the meeting halls of Manchester, the streets of Glasgow, and in Irish neighbourhoods in London, and of course many other places in Britain. The book is Conflict, Diaspora and Empire, Irish Nationalism in Britain, 1912 to 1922. Last year it was awarded the Donald Murphy Prize, honourable mention, by the American Conference for Irish Studies. It's out now in paperback, published by Cambridge University Press. The author is my guest, Dr. Dara Gannon. Dara, many thanks for joining us.
Thank you.